It arrived aboard the HMS Seahorse, a British warship. By the time the epidemic had burned itself out a year later, approximately half the town's 11,000 inhabitants had been infected. Among those who had escaped death were nearly 300 men, women, and children who had undergone inoculation. The story of the Boston smallpox epidemic of 1721 includes an improbable cast of characters embroiled in a controversy that would revolutionize not just American medicine, but speed the American colonies down the path to revolution. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Stephen Koss, the author of the book The Fever of 1721, published in 2016 by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman.
Well, I have to ask first, now you wrote this book back, well, over the course of several years, but published originally in 2016, well before COVID-19. What got you interested in it? And I assume it's having something of a rebirth.
Yes, it definitely is. Well, what got me into it was, improbably enough, a fact-a-day calendar that I got from my wife and kids one Christmas. And, you know, just one of those desk calendars where you rip the page off and every page has a piece of trivia. And this one happened to be historical trivia and scientific trivia. And one of the pages talked about the 1721 Boston smallpox epidemic and the first inoculation trial in Western medicine. And, you know, at that point, I knew very little about that. I don't have a traditional historian's background. I was working in advertising and marketing communications. And I actually envisioned the story I wanted to tell initially in the form of a screenplay. So I did a little research on it, and the more I discovered, the more fascinated I got. I did write a screenplay and, you know, threw it in a drawer for about a decade, didn't do anything with it. And then a good friend of mine, Jim Campbell, who you know, you've talked to him, an author in from Lodi, Wisconsin. He heard about this idea, and he said, you know, you should really write this as a nonfiction book. And so I spent several more years doing research and eventually did write the book.
And what about epidemics in America prior to 1721? How much do we know?
Well, we know that, you know, I think as everybody knows, as soon as Europeans began coming to the shore of North America, they brought a lot of disease with them, and it affected the indigenous peoples here, the Native Americans. And smallpox was one of those diseases. So pretty much the story of Westerners and Europeans, not only in North America, but also in Mexico and South America and Central America, that story really is a story of smallpox. We know that smallpox was in North America as early as early 1600s. So the first Boston smallpox epidemic was in the early 1600s, and Boston was one of the primary outposts in North America. So we certainly know that, you know, there were other diseases as well. There was measles, there was yellow fever, there was influenza, diphtheria, there was dysentery, there was all kinds of things except bubonic plague, ironically enough, which everybody feared, but it never came. Really the story of American history, if you start it with, to the extent you start it with the arrival of Europeans, white Europeans, is really the story of disease.
What causes smallpox?
Well, smallpox is, it's a virus. It's ironically a very large virus, as viruses go. It's called smallpox, but it's actually, as viruses go, quite large. Smallpox is an ancient disease. I think like many viruses, nobody knows exactly where it originated. It seems to have started with animals, like many viruses, and made the jump to humans. But that happened a long time ago. I mean, there were the earliest recorded description of smallpox dates back to 1350 BC. So, you know, this is an ancient disease that's been with humans ever since. And it is a disease of human-to-human transferal, not unlike COVID. So bubonic plague, in contrast, is a disease brought by mice and insects that are infected with it. This smallpox is really, the story of smallpox is the story of people interacting with people, whether that's because they're at war with them or they're doing, you know, having trade with them or living with them. So it's very much a person-to-person disease. And it, as I say, it has existed, probably made the jump in ancient times, and it has existed or did exist all the way up until the 1970s.
And the American colonies, what was the survivability of smallpox?
Well, not unlike COVID, it varied widely depending upon who you were. There were certain populations that seemed especially vulnerable, including Native Americans. Native Americans were wiped out in droves by smallpox. And this was even before anyone thought of something like a smallpox blanket or something, you know, using it as some kind of biological warfare. They just became ill because they had interaction trade and other interactions with white European colonists who brought it over with them. And they turned out to be especially susceptible. There are parts of New England where 90% of the Native Americans were wiped out well before the American Revolution. And so there was certainly that. They were an extreme case. There were, on average, smallpox was deadly about 30% of the time. And it was a little higher if you were very young or very old.
And having gotten it once, were you guaranteed immunity?
You were, and that was the beauty of it, to the extent there can be a beauty to it. If you survived, and if you survived without some of the permanent after effects, which included, you know, hideous scarring in a lot of cases, facial scarring, you know, mental problems due to secondary infections, lameness, blindness. It's actually one of the leading causes, or it was one of the leading causes of blindness in the world before it was eradicated. So if you survived it, you did have the one consolation that you could not get it again.
And do we see a pattern, as implied in our opening there, with this ship, the HMS Seahorse, coming into Boston? Is there a pattern of, oh my gosh, here comes another ship from England, it's going to bring smallpox?
Well, what's interesting about that is, so smallpox came almost like clockwork to Boston. They knew it was coming. It came about every 12 years, and no one really understood why. And I think probably in retrospect, we would say, like most epidemics, it needed enough vulnerable people to really take hold. So if an epidemic came, you know, 1 year and it killed a number of people survived, it was a long time before there were enough people who were vulnerable for it really to get some steam up and become a full-fledged epidemic. So it was probably coming into Boston, I wouldn't say regularly, but you know, occasionally, on ships. Boston was the number one seaport in North America, and it was actually the number three seaport in the entire British Empire. So it was a very, very busy place, largest town in America at that point. And, you know, when ships came in, they would bring it, and then there would be an outbreak, and maybe, well, usually almost exactly 12 years would go by. And after that 12 years, everybody knew smallpox was coming back. And sure enough, there would be another epidemic, and it would do its damage, and eventually it would burn itself out when it ran out of people to kill, essentially. And then it would go away, and et cetera, et cetera. It went on and on. In this case, in 1721, what made this remarkable and what made it the worst smallpox epidemic they'd ever had was that for some reason it didn't come back after 12 years. It came back closer to 20 years, after 20 years. So as you can imagine, there were many children had been born in that time. Many people had moved into Boston. It was growing because people were transplanting there from other places seeking opportunity. So there was an enormous amount of vulnerable people. It's sort of like dry kindling, if you think of a fire analogy or metaphor. And that's why when the epidemic hit, it was so disastrous.
We're talking about a population of 11,000 in Boston in 1721. And yet there seems to have been quite a political dynamic going on, even with such a small population.
Yeah, there was. I mean, as I said, this was, you know, we think now of 11,000, 12,000 people as not a lot of people, which indeed, by contemporary standards, it's not. But Boston was the most populous town in the colonies, and it was also sort of the center of the colonies, the New York, if you will, of its day, in terms of people coming in from abroad. It was the point from which everyone went and came. It was a center of business, it was a center of trade. So it was a situation where it was also the center of kind of political controversy. It had a royal governor, as did most of the colonies. And it was the place because there was the most money to be made there, I think in part, because there was the most opportunity there both for the colonists and for the crown. Every decision became a contest for who was going to get dominance. Was it going to be the Americans looking after their own interests or the crown looking after its interests? And so along with all the other things it also had a very feverish political atmosphere.
In 1721, who was the British governor of the colony?
So the governor in 1721 was a man named Samuel Chute, and he had been governor for a number of years at that point. He had been sent to the colony, to Massachusetts, specifically because he was a former war hero. He was a military man, and he had, Parliament thought, what Boston really needed, what Massachusetts really needed, was to be kind of whipped into shape, because they had already protested navigation acts, and they'd already stood up against a lot of the dictates from England. And their solution, from England's point of view, the solution was to come down harder on the colonists. So they sent Samuel Chute, who was in his mid-50s, had been a war hero, had no political experience, as was the case often with the appointed governors at that time, and came in and almost instantly picked a fight. And that was a bad thing to do, because Bostonians were and are people who are inclined to fight back.
Who did he pick a fight with?
Well, he specifically picked a fight with a politician, a very important American politician many people don't know, named Elisha Cook. Elisha Cook was part of a dynasty, one of really the earliest, I think, dynasties, political dynasties in America. His father had been extremely important in Massachusetts. He took up where his father left off. They were also very wealthy. And he was very, as his father had been, very independent. His father had fought really for economic independence from England. So even way before the American Revolution, there's a line of thinking that, at least in Massachusetts, because it was kind of colony by colony at that point, but at least in Massachusetts, the thought was, we'll do what the crown says, but we want to reap the benefits of our own labor and our own adventuresomeness and all this stuff. So they were not inclined to follow rules. And Elisha Cook Sr. and Elisha Cook Jr., his son, both pushed back a lot against the royal government. Elisha Cook Jr. was a brilliant and charismatic politician and something of a barroom brawler. He was a tough guy who kind of dressed like the common man, who reached out to the common man and recruited a lot of people who were eligible to vote but never did into the process. So he expanded the amount of voters in Massachusetts, and thereby managed to acquire an enormous amount of political power, which nobody had ever done before, and created what came to be known as the Boston Caucus, which would live on into the era of the Revolution and be instrumental in fomenting the Revolution. So Elisha Cook was the primary foe or nemesis of Samuel Chute, but he had a lot of support, not only from the elected legislature, which was mostly allied with him, but just in general with the people. And as Chute made more and more bad decisions and clumsy decisions in terms of ruling, he lost popularity with the people too.
So you have this clumsy, heavy-handed royal governor, Samuel Chute, and you have I'm going to call him a firebrand American, independent-minded Elisha Cook Jr. and his followers, how does the smallpox epidemic of 1721 play into that dynamic?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. You know, the first, the most kind of straightforward answer is to say that smallpox became a weapon in the standoff between, by early 1721, they were pretty much at loggerheads. Shute was the royal governor, but Elisha Cook and the House of Representatives, which is one of the two houses of the Massachusetts legislature, they were at loggerheads over a number of issues. And unfortunately for England, the problem was that although England appointed the royal governor, it was Massachusetts who paid him and who, in fact, they had power of the purse on every expenditure that he was commanded to, you know, to make on behalf of the crown. So, you know, as I said, Cook had an enormous amount of power and the legislature had an enormous amount of power going into 1721. And then they were pretty much at a standoff at that point, fighting for control of the colony when smallpox arrived. And what smallpox did literally was really start this game of chicken between the elected legislature and the governor to see who would prevail. The governor, basically before this whole thing was over, the governor intentionally exposed the members of House of Representatives to he didn't know that he was exposing them to smallpox. He kept them sequestered in an area of town that was overrun with smallpox in the hope of forcing their hand and getting them to make concessions to him. And so smallpox became a biological political weapon.
We're going to look at some of the other players in this cast of characters involved in the fever of 1721, the smallpox epidemic that hit Boston so hard. And we'll do that shortly. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Stephen Koss. He's the author of the book, The Fever of 1721, The Epidemic That Revolutionized Medicine and American Politics. And we're starting to look at some of the political dynamics that existed in Boston in that year of 1721, a solidly colonial year, and yet there was already some independent-minded individuals, groups of individuals, the Boston Caucus, led by Elisha Cook Jr., for one, on the one side, and then the royal governor from England, Samuel Shute, who was trying to impose his power over those obstreperous Americans. And then we have this epidemic in 1721 that also plays very powerfully into the politics of the time and place. And we have talked about Elisha Cook Jr., obviously, and Samuel Shute, but some of the other characters are a little bit surprising, at least from a contemporary standpoint. When we talk about and introduce this concept of inoculation for smallpox, Cotton Mather is a prominent player, and we associate him, of course, primarily with the Salem witch trials back in 1692. What's his attitude toward handling the smallpox epidemic?
Cotton Mather was one of the most fascinating people of that era because for the very reason you alluded to. You know, he's on the one hand, he has pretty much become identified with the Salem witch trials, which ironically he didn't actually participate in, but he certainly bore a lot of responsibility for fomenting the kind of craziness that led to the witch trials and for not denouncing them when he should have. So he does play a role, but he is sort of the man who was branded with the Salem witch trials. So we think of him as a result of that as understandably, as a very superstitious person and as someone who doesn't have the best interests of the community necessarily at heart. My book talks about Mather 30 years later. So he was actually a very young man at the time of Salem. I think he's about 29 years old. So now he's 30 years older, somewhat wiser. Some people wouldn't say 30 years wiser, but he was wiser than Salem. And you see sort of the other side of him. Salem was such a disaster in retrospect for him that it took him 30 years of trying to, and he was still trying in 1721 to kind of get past it and to be thought of as somebody other than one of the villains of the Salem witch trials. So in the all the years, or many of the years, between Salem and 1721, he had done what he really did quite well, which was study. He was a brilliant man. He was the youngest graduate of Harvard College at that point in time. He had the largest personal library of anyone in the colonies, and maybe the largest personal library that existed, institutional or otherwise. He was especially keen on science because early on in his preaching career, he developed a stutter, and he thought that his stutter was going to prohibit him from continuing on as a preacher. And so he began to think about becoming a doctor. So he was, in his mind, always interested in what was happening in medicine. And he kept that interest through the decades, not just medicine, but all kinds of science. He was one of the few people in the colonies to receive what was then the foremost scientific journal of its time, which was called the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, Royal Society being in England. And he received that, unlike almost everybody else in America, and he read it, and he actually aspired to contribute to it. So he went out and did a lot of studies about nature and about astronomy and various things and about medicine. And he sent some contributions to the Royal Society. And this was several years before the smallpox epidemic I write about. And he finally got one of them. He thought he was going to get a bunch of them printed, and he ended up getting about 10 pages, which disappointed him greatly because he was a very egotistical man. But he got it. That was quite an accomplishment to be published in the foremost, journal of its time. And it just so happened that in that same journal, immediately following his piece, there was an anecdotal report of this process from Turkey, which involved this thing they called inoculation. And that was taking smallpox. When smallpox came to a town or a village, they would, and someone actually got it, they would take pus from a pustule on someone who was sick with it. They would make an incision in the arm or the leg of someone who was healthy. They would implant the incision with smallpox, and the person who was inoculated with smallpox would develop a minor case of the disease and then have immunity. So Mather saw this, and of course he had suffered from smallpox in a previous epidemic and survived. And he also had an enslaved African servant named Onesimus. And Onesimus is one of the unsung heroes of this story. He was a slave who had been given to Mather as a gift from his congregation in about 1708 as a fairly young man, probably a boy, and had lived with the Mather family since then. And Mather had kind of taken him on as a special project, if you will. Mather was... it's hard to talk about race in this period because nobody was right. But Mather was, I would say, progressive in the sense that he believed that Africans had souls and that Africans could be educated, which, low bar that it was actually quite higher a bar than anybody else at that time. And so he made a point of he became actually very close to Onesimus and almost as an extended member of his family, albeit still and always a slave. But they were close enough so that Onesimus, at one point, Mather asked Onesimus about a distinctive scar on his arm. And Onesimus told Mather that in Africa, when he was a boy, whenever smallpox would come to their village, they would practice inoculation, and he explained inoculation, as I just did, the process of it. And Mather, sometimes, we don't know exactly what the order was, but either that came first and then Mather read about it in the Royal Transactions, or vice versa. But they came pretty closely one after the other. And Mather, to his credit, I think even before, I think probably Onesimus was first, and I think even before the Royal Transactions came along, Mather knew that, or believed that Onesimus was telling the truth. No one had ever asked any African slave in Boston about the scars on their arms. Nobody, you know, he wasn't the only one inoculated, but no one had ever thought to ask. So Mather asked him, Onesimus told him about the procedure. And so Mather, when the smallpox epidemic came back in 1721, Mather was frankly somewhat out of self-interest, looking for a way to redeem himself. Still, after all these years, after Salem, and to prove he was not a man of superstition, he was a man of science. And so he took these two bits of knowledge from the journal and from Onesimus to the doctors of Boston and urged them to try inoculation.
How did they receive that?
Not well. all the doctors but one turned him down. In fact, they wouldn't even talk to him about it. He wrote a letter, asked them to consider it amongst themselves, to get back to him. He didn't want to overstep his bounds. He waited 2 weeks. He heard nothing. And finally, he sent another letter to a subset of doctors, about three doctors, who, for some reason, he thought would take it more seriously. And it was one of those doctors, whose name is Abdiel Boylston, who eventually agreed to try the inoculation experiment.
Who gets a street in Boston named in his honor after all these years?
That's Boylston. Right, yeah.
Were there any ideas of inoculating people of lower classes as a kind of a demonstration?
That's an interesting idea, you know, and it's funny, that's not the way it happened, although in England it did happen that way. So there was an inoculation experiment not long after Boylston did his in England that was conducted with prisoners who volunteered, and then subsequently at an orphanage with young children in an orphanage. So these were obviously people who were of a lower class and who couldn't afford to pay for inoculation. Of course, people thought it was very dangerous, and they were also seen to be more expendable, frankly. So it was experimented on them. In Boston, in contrast, when Boylston decided to try the inoculation experiment, he made one of the first three subjects his own son, his six-year-old son, Thomas. And the way I explain that is, I think Boylston realized that what he was proposing was so preposterous, and the urgency was such, because this was right in the middle of the epidemic, so they didn't have time for trials and didn't have time to, you know, handpick a group of people and see how they did before they tried it on other people. They basically needed to save lives as quickly as possible. So he needed to try it for real right away, and he needed someone who was willing, and he needed also, I think most importantly, to show that he believed in this so much that he was willing to potentially sacrifice his own child.
Kind of an Abraham and Isaac situation.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, he was right in a sense, but it also backfired because people were even more outraged that he would try this on his own son.
And he was not in a position where he could actually inoculate himself?
No, he had also survived smallpox. And in fact, he had nearly died of smallpox. In the previous epidemic, when he was a new doctor, he was still apprenticing as a doctor. And smallpox came to Boston, and he intentionally exposed himself, knowing that if he was going to be a doctor and he was going to do good in this town, he was eventually going to come across smallpox, so he might as well get it over with. So he intentionally, in like 1702, when smallpox hit, he intentionally exposed himself, thinking that he would knock it off pretty easily. He was a young, vital man. But instead, he almost died. His own doctor gave him up for dead. And he did eventually survive, but he had, what we're told is, there are no portraits of him, but we're told that he had very bad facial disfigurement from smallpox scars.
And how did his six-year-old son fare after the inoculation?
Well, his six-year-old son was one of the first three people. So he inoculated his son, he inoculated He was a slave owner as well, as were many people, many whites in Boston. He inoculated his slave, Jack, who was also his medical assistant, because he needed him to come with him on calls. And then he inoculated, Jack asked him to inoculate his son, Jack's son, Jackie, who was 2.5 years old. So Boylston inoculated the three of them on the same day in 1721. And Jack came through, Jack and Jackie both came through very well. They had very minimal reaction. There's speculation that Jack might have actually had a mild case of smallpox earlier in his life, and so was immune already, or partly immune. Thomas Boylston actually developed a very high fever. And so for about 2 days, Boylston was hoping what would happen was he would get a low fever, a few localized pox that broke out in the area of the incision, which is what Mather had told him would happen. And then Thomas would be fine. Well, instead, Thomas actually got quite ill and developed a very high fever. And for a day or two, Boylston was really, really feared for his life. He did, however, recover entirely with only some localized, pox around the incision in his arm. No other effects, no scarring on his face or any of the other more terrible after effects. And so Boylston had enough confidence based on that to continue.
How did it play to the populace in general?
People were outraged. People had never heard of this procedure before. I mentioned it was in the Royal Society Journal, but journals in those days were less like our contemporary scientific journal and more like, half journal, half Ripley's Believe It or Not. People would send stuff in from far-flung places, and a lot of it was just anecdotal stuff that it wasn't meant to be prescriptive. It wasn't meant to be, we tried inoculation and you should too. It was just sort of an account of this strange procedure happening in a distant part of the world. And so certainly the doctors who heard about this didn't think that Boylston had any real evidence to try this and believe that it was going to work. He had this bizarre story from the Ripley's Believe It or Not version of the magazine, of the journal, and then he had the word of an enslaved African who nobody believed because he was an African. So Boylston met with instantaneous outrage in the town. They said before the sun was set, because it was a small town, there were only 11,000 people plus there. Before the sun was set, people knew about it and they were outraged. And immediately he began facing very strong reactions on the street. People insulted him. They spat at him. They threatened him. And as it went on, it got worse.
The classic, I'm going to call them anti-vaxxers or anti-inoculars, I guess. How did the politicians play in this drama? The governor, Samuel Shute, and the American, Elisha Cook.
Well, what's interesting is at the very beginning, they kept themselves sort of out of the inoculation controversy. But what's so interesting and what will ring true, I think, for a lot of people today is that one of the reasons the epidemic happened was because of politics and economics. And what happened was, you mentioned the smallpox came in on a ship called the Seahorse. Well, the Seahorse was a British naval ship. Commercial ships were obligated to, actually all ships were obligated to self-quarantine if anyone on board was sick. So they did have quarantine. That was their one weapon against epidemic disease. And there was an island, still is an island, off of Boston called Spectacle Island. And Spectacle Island was the designated pest house. So if you came in on it, if you were the captain of a ship and your ship was infected, or you believed it might be, you were supposed to, instead of coming to Long Wharf, to Boston proper, you were supposed to stop at Spectacle Island and remain there until everyone was healthy or died. And that's the way it usually went. But the Seahorse, because it was a British naval ship, was not obligated to follow the rules of quarantine. They were and felt like they had a higher authority and they could do whatever they wanted. So the ship came into town. The disease began to spread, and pretty early on, the elected officials, the governor and the elected officials, so the town level and the colony level, became aware that there were smallpox back in Boston. They were in a position at that point to quarantine the ship and to quarantine all the sailors who'd come in on the ship. Or at least they could try to. Some of them were already at shore leave. But they were in a position to stop it, and they didn't. They tried to hide the fact that smallpox was in Boston. And they did it for arguably the same reason that we saw such a reluctance to, you know, admit to COVID-19, and why, in fact, almost every epidemic gets out of control in a populous place. It's because of money, because of the economy. Shute knew, and the elected officials of Boston and Massachusetts knew, that if word got out that smallpox was loose in Boston, the town would be embargoed. Ships would stop coming in. Commerce would stop happening. The economy would ground to a halt. And they were an economy based entirely on trade. So that was, obviously, that was a terrifying prospect for them, and would bring along a whole set of problem for, you know, if an economic depression happened. But as is also the case, you know, wishful thinking doesn't prevent an epidemic. So the role of the politicians early on was in failing to act promptly and boldly to stop this from getting out of control. Once it got out of control, there was very little they could do. And they oddly enough, on a local level, on a town level, the politicians tried to stop the inoculation experiment. In fact, Boylston was called before this special tribunal, which I consider sort of a kangaroo court, where he was sort of surprised and overwhelmed by opposition from the government, from fellow doctors, and from a lot of people, except for, oddly enough, a number of the ministers who, along with Mather, supported him. But yeah, the government was at first inactive and then tried to stop inoculation, at least on the local level after.
Was Boylston successful? We implied again at the beginning of the hour that we're talking about 300 men, women, and children who had undergone inoculation. Was that at the hand of Boylston?
Yes, most of those inoculations were Boylston's. Towards the end, once Boylston had proven to pretty much everybody's satisfaction that this process worked, then a few other doctors joined in and also inoculated within that area. Boylston, though, was alone for most of a year during which he performed inoculations. So even after, as I mentioned, the government, the local government, called him before a tribunal and basically ordered him to stop inoculating, he continued inoculating, and you know, at great risk to his own safety. Lynch mobs were after him at various points in time. He had to hide. His wife had to hide him. He would come out only at night and in disguise, we think, sometimes to perform inoculations. Cotton Mather, who, you know, we mentioned gave him the idea, was also held culpable for this. Cotton Mather's house was firebombed during this period. So, yeah, so it was it was kind of a bad scene in terms of all that.
We'll look at some of the other members of the cast of characters involved in this fever of 1721, including a remarkable teenager who played a significant role in it, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Stephen Koss. He's the author of the book, The Fever of 1721, The Epidemic That Revolutionized Medicine and American Politics. And we're looking at Boston, hard hit in that year of 1721, 11,000 of its inhabitants in terror of a smallpox epidemic, which has become to some extent politicized. And Zabdiel Boylston, a doctor, has bravely inoculated his son and two of his slaves, and all of them have come through it. And eventually, a total of some 300 men, women, and children undergo inoculation during this epidemic. I mentioned this 15-year-old, and his brother at the time, his older brother by 9 years, James, would have been much better known than Benjamin Franklin. What part did they play as printers in this epidemic?
Benjamin Franklin, as you say, was 15 years old. He was an apprentice, a printer's apprentice, to his older brother, James. They were struggling when this epidemic broke out. James had come back from England, having done his own printer's apprenticeship. He was a young man as well, as you mentioned. And he came back thinking he was going to, show the printers a thing or two in Boston. Boston was, as you can imagine, up to that point, it was a Puritan town. It was pretty staid. It was pretty, frankly, you know, it could be pretty boring. They had two newspapers, both of which were considered boring. They were considered mouthpieces of the royal government. In fact, the purpose of a newspaper in its earliest iteration in America was to provide the government and influential people with a sort of abridged view of all the news that was coming in on the boats. And so it wasn't doing reporting in any sense that we think of it, or having opinions in any sense that we think of the newspapers sense. It was just, an arm of the government. So when smallpox broke out in this inoculation, and Boylston started inoculating, as I said, it became an enormous controversy. Many, many people were against it. Some people obviously were for it, and that number would grow as time went on. But it was this enormous controversy. Everybody was talking about it. And James Franklin, who needed work badly and needed some way to get a foothold in publishing and printing in Boston, decided to start a newspaper, at least nominally opposed to inoculation, because that was the majority view. That would sell the most newspapers. So he started a newspaper in August of 1721 called the New England Courant, and his younger brother Benjamin helped him print it. And what made the Courant pretty remarkable was that the other papers, as I said, were really concerned about censorship and really concerned about not doing anything that was going to offend the government. And the New England Courant came out without asking government permission, without seeming to even care about what the government thought, and immediately became controversial. Published pieces by people strongly opposed to inoculation, who attacked Boylston, who attacked Cotton Mather, who, although, you know, I say he was trying to redeem himself, he was, but he was also still a very powerful man. And it was unheard of for someone to attack the clergy in a Boston newspaper. And yet James Franklin did. Not only that, but he also then, within a few weeks of the beginning of the paper, he began expanding the scope of what he did. So then he started, publishing satire about marriage and about sex and about the government and about all these things that were, considered absolutely off limits. No one talked about them out loud, and certainly no one printed anything about them. But James did, and he created what I think of as the first truly American, first independent newspaper in American history.
Now, Benjamin Franklin, at the age of 15, was a mere apprentice. What power would he have in this printing firm during this epidemic?
Well, he had, like all apprentices, he had no power. He was little better than a slave. The difference between apprentices and slaves in Boston, in some cases, was not very great, except that, obviously, slavery could be in perpetuity and apprenticeship was not. But a master could do whatever he wanted to an apprentice. And James Franklin did, in fact, beat Benjamin Franklin physically, which, if you read the autobiography, you know, Benjamin alludes to that. So Benjamin was powerless. But even though he was powerless, and even though the brothers had a strained relationship, to say the least, being in James's printing shop, being among all those printed words, you're being in the library of the printing shop, which had some of the latest publications from England, political philosophy and things of that sort. Being there to overhear James having political discussions and social discussions with his friends, who were a group of young men who were very, like him, not wealthy, not formally educated, but very ambitious and very interested in knowledge and thirsty for knowledge. This really was the, you know, formative period in Benjamin Franklin's life. This is where he went from being what he had been, which was the apprentice to his father in his candle-making shop, to a future publisher and printer and thinker. And it was because he was surrounded in this environment, and he was so inspired by this environment that before this story is over, he would actually go into print for the first time secretly as Silence Do Good.
And on the basis of that Silence Do Good piece, he won some kind of validity, some kind of recognition as a writer? Or how long did that go on as an anonymous Benjamin Franklin?
He was actually anonymous as Silence Do Good for the entire time he submitted articles. So the Current was a weekly newspaper at that point. He was submitting a new Silence Do Good letter almost every week. For several months, and the letters covered a whole bunch of different things. They were all they weren't all humorous. Most were humorous. Some got more serious towards the end. But he would write them secretly. He would at the end of the day when the shop was closed, he would slip them under the printing house door, and then he'd come in the next day and he'd listen to James and his friends try to figure out who Silence Do Good was. Because they knew it probably was not a woman. Women generally did not contribute as authors at that point in time. But they didn't think it was him. They didn't think this, you know, at that point, 15-year-old young kid who was pretty bright, but come on, could write like in the personage of a widow, a minister's widow from the country named Silence Do Good, and could write so perceptively about what was going on. So they had no idea it was him. And finally, Benjamin stopped doing it for a variety of reasons. We don't know why he stopped, but he did stop. I've got some ideas about why. But when he stopped, it was only then that he told James that he was Silence Do Good, and it did not go well. James was very upset, I think partly because he'd been shown up by his little brother. James was also writing, and James was a very smart man, a very good writer, a very good editor. He was no slouch, and if he had the misfortune to be Ben Franklin's older brother, we might be talking about him more often. But, you know, he was outshone by this kid, and everybody else, all of his friends were just amazed and overjoyed and, you know, giving the equivalent of high fives or whatever they did back then to young Ben. And James was embarrassed and humiliated, and it was just not a thing that happened that an apprentice would do something without the approval of his master. And that was really the beginning of the end of their relationship.
James, as you mentioned earlier, Stephen, was coming out in print, at least, against inoculation. Did young Benjamin, at the age of 15, actually make pronouncements about a stand on inoculation?
He did not. Very interestingly enough, when he started writing in Silence Do Good, he steered totally clear of inoculation. And we know from his future life and events things he did in the future that he was won over to inoculation, privately at least, during this period. When he left Boston, when he came back, one of the first things he did on his first visit back to Boston was to go see Cotton Mather, which was remarkable because Cotton Mather was his brother's sworn enemy. I mean, Cotton Mather and James Franklin had said terrible things about each other in print and on the street and everywhere else, but somehow Ben went to see Cotton Mather. And I speculate it was basically to say, you know what, you were right. You were right for proposing inoculation. This is a good thing. And Ben would eventually, in Philadelphia, become a champion of inoculation and make Philadelphia really the center for inoculation in the years leading up to the Revolution.
It's easy to say, oh, well, this fever of 1721 then demonstrated to all, once and for all, the value of inoculation. But if we look further toward the years leading up to the American Revolution, I mean, Thomas Jefferson had to go from Virginia to Philadelphia to get a legal inoculation.
That's right. Yeah, inoculation was illegal in Virginia. It was illegal many places at the time. And so, as you say, Jefferson traveled to Philadelphia and was inoculated there because it was known as the sort of the epicenter, the headquarters of inoculation. And a lot of that was because Franklin had made it so.
And George Washington and his troops during the Revolution, did he have them inoculated?
He did. Famously, George Washington in 1777 began inoculating his troops in secret. And he was able to pull them off the battlefield. The ones who were already in the army, he pulled off the battlefield in groups and had them inoculated and then snuck them basically back on the battlefield, hoping that there wouldn't be a major, you know, British offensive in the meantime, because it would have been disastrous. But and then as new troops came into the army, he ordered them inoculated so they would be maybe no worry of smallpox for them as soon as they became soldiers. But this was a an enormous thing for George Washington to do. Some historians say it's the most important thing he did as general, because if the same time, people don't realize, the same time that the American Revolution was happening, there was also the first continental smallpox epidemic. And it actually killed more people, smallpox did, than died in the war. So it was a major threat to everyone. And it was a major threat to American independence because it wasn't going well already. And if Washington's army was severely hampered by smallpox or decimated by smallpox, there would be very little chance of the revolution succeeding, the military revolution succeeding. So, you know, many historians will say that Washington's greatest move tactically as a general was to inoculate. And to his credit, he did that not having been inoculated. He suffered natural occurring smallpox as a younger man, but he learned about it and he became a proponent of it.
Did the British not inoculate their troops?
Many of the British troops, because in England, smallpox was more endemic versus pandemic. So it was more likely that and it also could be, but not always was, less severe. So a lot of British troops, by the time they came to the colonies, had had smallpox and had survived. And so in terms of sheer numbers, there were many fewer British troops susceptible to it than Americans.
And then the last, I'm going to say, for our purposes at least, the last step in progress was from inoculation to vaccination.
That's right, yeah. And interesting, you mentioned Jefferson. Jefferson was president when vaccination came to America. And in England, obviously it came from England because it involved basically the difference between vaccination and inoculation was that vaccination at that point in time was the same process, the taking pus from something and putting an incision and implanting the incision, except what vaccination did was substitute cowpox for smallpox. Dr. Jenner in England realized that, and a number of other people as well, actually, but he was the doctor who formally experimented with it. He realized that cowpox kept milkmaids, the women who milked cows in England, from getting smallpox. And he and a number of other people came to the conclusion that that was because cowpox, which is very fairly common and a mild disease, nothing serious, would they be susceptible to cowpox. And he realized that was enough to inoculate against smallpox. He did the experiment, and it was Jefferson who embraced it in America, and they started experimenting with that as well. And interestingly enough, when it was experimented with in America, the first experimentation happened again with a doctor and his son, like Boylston, and perhaps in tribute to Boylston.
Well, Stephen Koss, thank you for shining some light on a little known part of American history, The Fever of 1721. That's the name of his book, the subtitle, The Epidemic That Revolutionized Medicine and American Politics. And it's been a pleasure hearing about this story from you, Stephen Koss.
Thank you, Norman. Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.